You are endlessly positive, Sean.
I know.
Is this what breathing recycled farts does to you in a submarine?
Exactly, yeah. It messes with your head.
Welcome to Season 1, Episode 11 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
So, Sean, while I'm busy out here in Singapore working hard teaching Swift, I believe you have an admission to make.
Yeah, I lost my battle with an addiction. I fought hard for 3 months, did everything I could to resist it, but finally gave in and I purchased the new iPad Pro with everything, the keyboard, the pencil, the whole shebang. Even though I have almost no need for it, I just wanted it. But I blame those damn YouTube suggested videos. You know, they pop up on the side like, you know, look at my iPad Pro, look at this. So I went down that rabbit hole and just finally gave in.
I don't think a major YouTube personality like Sean Allen gets to complain about YouTube. You just don't have that right, man. You've forgotten that right already.
That is true. I will say most of my views come from suggested videos, so I cannot. Don't bite the hand that feeds you, right?
Yeah. But are you loving it? Is it significantly better than your previous iPad?
I mean, it's way too early to tell. I literally have it less than 24 hours, and I played basketball last night, so I think I've only had actually like 3 to 4 hours to even attempt to like play with it. So way too early to tell, but I'm really curious how I'm going to incorporate it into my workflow. I'm going to try to force it in. I'm inspired by John Sindel. I know he's using it a lot for his developer workflow. So I'm going to really try and do that with the developer stuff and, you know, the YouTube stuff as well. So we'll see how it goes. All right, let's dive into some news, Paul. And up first, we have an article from Ben Sandusky of Halide called The Trouble with Manager Objects. Now, right away, this article jumped out at me because I have about 5 objects with manager in the title of my current project. So I was like, okay, what's this all about?
Okay, so I I've just got to interrupt you here. I need more information. Give me some details here. Tell us, listeners, some juicy facts about these managers you have.
I think a network manager, I think that's pretty standard. I think a lot of people have that. I also have a session manager to manage like my user, you know, because there's some, it's a singleton. Mm. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff with the user that needs to be accessed from a lot of places. And then we have a device manager because our app has a hardware component to it. There's a external device that connects via Bluetooth. So I'm kind of, you know, managing all the, you know, is connected, not connected, among other things. So those three, the network, session, and device, I think those are fine. After reading this article, I do think I could probably clean some stuff up a bit. For example, I have an analytics manager. Maybe I could call that something else or you know, clean that up a little bit to handle all my
just analytics. Rename it slightly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like he says in the article, just refactor and change the name of it. You know, don't do anything to it. So those are the managers that I'm working with, you know, right now at the moment. But back to the article, it talks about how, you know, sometimes engineers try to solve this massive view controller problem just by abstracting away a large part of the functionality into a new class and just attaching the word manager to the end of it. You know, like I just mentioned, I'm not doing this, but I have seen it before. And he points out that we should just be a bit more deliberate and focus on the separation of concerns, you know, making sure one object isn't doing too much.
And it's such a complicated topic. I mean, it's one of those it depends things, right? It often feels right to organize code in this way, to say this thing manages user data, this thing manages network calls and so forth, because it clearly marks where we think responsibilities fall. It's like the whole solid thing, single responsibility principle, is yes. But then you can just end up with this huge network class or a massive user class, whatever, and both are a pretty poor end result. I mean, what is the solution? Is there a solution?
Like you said, it's tricky, but he does present a specific alternative here, saying that we need to break things up into groups, you know, more than just network. And I see what he means. For example, my network manager that I previously mentioned has about 11 network calls in it, comes in at about 311 lines of code, which breaks my 250 line rule of thumb, which kind of gives me anxiety a little bit. But, you know, if it got much bigger, then I would definitely break it out into more logical groups. Like I said, it's kind of right at the cusp of how big I want it to be. But overall, the sentiment of the article is to be careful about your managers doing too much, which I think is a good practice to get into.
So don't try and trade massive view controllers for massive managers.
Yeah, exactly. He had a good analogy in the article. I think he says like it's like cleaning up your living room by sweeping all the dirt into the closet or something like that. It was a pretty good analogy. We'll have to read the article to check that one out. But up next, we have an article from Orta Therox of Artsy making the case that now it's time to make the switch to Swift Package Manager, or SPM as we'll call it, for third-party dev tools. While he admits that SPM is still very early in its life, he points out that some recent changes have, you know, now made it ready for adoption. Things like the addition of the command Swift Run, as well as a lot of big third-party tools are supporting it. So, Paul, in my workflow, I haven't even really begun to dive into SPM or even given it much thought. I've still just stuck to CocoaPods. Does Orta have a case here? Is it time to give SPM a chance?
So this coming from Orta, who has worked extensively on CocoaPods, makes it really important. You know, this guy's got a lot of experience doing CocoaPods. And for him to say, maybe it's time to start using SPM for some things, is big. It shows SPM's finally getting a maturity it didn't have before. Now, I've been using it for about maybe 18 months or longer. And although it has improved a little, it still desperately needs more work. You know, package.swift, which is the equivalent of a pod file if you were using CocoaPods, is Swift code, which is nice, it's not Ruby, but it wouldn't take much to let us drive that from the command line rather than editing code by hand, which is what we do right now. Now, I know it's going to get better, of course it is, but right now it's just, it's useless for handling iOS apps, which is inexplicable, quite frankly. If folks are ever going to start using Xcode and SPM together rather than CocoaPods, that's the very first thing that needs to change. And maybe this year, WW19 will be the one it finally happens.
Yeah, hopefully. And maybe that explains why I haven't even looked into it. Like you said, it's useless for the iOS apps. But I am curious. You jumped onto it, you know, 18 months ago. So that was very, very early in the process. What was the reasoning for being one of those very, very early adopters?
Absolutely 100% server-side Swift.
Yeah.
That's where it's used extensively. I was using Katura at the time. Vapor uses it too. It is entirely a server-side Swift domain for me. It's fantastic there. It does the work really well. But it's still lots of Swift code.
Well, speaking of Katura, we know Ian Partridge works on that, and the next story is an article from him where he discusses how he did the advent of code during the month of December. Now, this is an exercise where you solve small coding puzzles each day throughout the month, and he took a shot at completing these using Swift. So during this month of puzzle solving, Ian ran into a few frustrations with the Swift language. You know, things like not having an exit function or a simple way to sum an array. Like we know we can use reduce, but, you know, he feels like that's very heavy handed versus, you know, issues with the string type, etc.
What he points out in the article again and again are simple, small, smart quality of life improvements to a language, all brought about through solving actual real world problems in this advent of code. And the pain of strings is crushingly real for a lot of people. Ian is one of the senior developers on Katura for IBM. He's done a huge amount of work porting Swift and Foundation to Linux. So if even he is having a hard time, it tells you exactly where we are with Swift. And I actually saw a brilliant, well, depressingly brilliant, tweet from Javier Soto from Twitch just a few days ago. He said, it makes me kind of sad that so many interview candidates that are passionate about Swift end up switching to something else like Python to solve my coding problems because working with strings and Swift is such a pain.
As always, Paul, let's talk about our picks for this episode. What do you got?
So my pick this time is really a pick I've had for the last month, because that was when I saw it being tweeted by John Reed. It's an article from a couple of years ago called Replace Booleans with Two-Cased Enumerations, and makes a case that before creating a Boolean property, consider making an enum with two cases instead.
Wait a minute. Isn't a Boolean just two cases, right? You just got true or false. What's the deal here?
Well, the point the author makes is threefold. First, that enums are explicit and descriptive. For example, we use something like UI views is hidden property a lot, sometimes negating it like with an exclamation mark to say not is hidden to mean is visible. But if we made that a two-case enum instead, we'd have something more explicit. Some view.viewState equals .hidden or .visible.
All right, I see where you're going with this. It's a readability thing, and anybody that follows me knows I love that. I love me some good readability. So I may be on board. What more do you got?
Well, the second thing he says is that enums give room to grow over time. So you can add a third case or more later on if you wanted, without breaking your code. So if you wanted to say, we don't know whether a view is hidden or not, we could add dot unknown.
All right, that's a good point. You haven't lost me yet. I'm still on board with this. You know, I was a little skeptical at first, but I'm still here. Keep going.
Well, the final point he makes is that enums are safer. And he breaks it down this one into two reasons. First, that with Booleans, you can assign one Boolean property to another, even when it doesn't make sense. For example, game.isPlaying equals user.isAuthenticated. Whereas if we had enums, there'd be two different types in SwiftDI, so you couldn't use them like this. Also, if you add extra cases to your enum, Swift will tell you it'll refuse to compile because of all the places it needs to be used in switch case statements.
All right, we might have hit our first speed bump here. I'm not sure if it's going to make me jump ship, but I kind of like being able to, you know, use those Booleans like that. I get what he's saying about how it's the readability might not be there, which I'm contradicting myself while being all about the readability. But I like the example you pointed out where you can say, you know, game.isPlaying, you know, equals user.isAuthenticated. So I don't know, maybe that's bad practice or not, but I do like that.
The thing is, if you want just to do comparing, you can still do it, but it has to be more explicit. You do something like, you know, if game state equals equals dot playing and user state equals equals dot authenticated. So, you know, I read this article a month ago when John tweeted it, and I'm still grappling with it. You know, I've tried writing code with Booleans, wrote over two case enums, and I have to admit the end result does seem nicer nearly all the time. At this point, I think I have to really write something on it, an article or something, just to get my thoughts kind of clear in my head. Anyway, enough about my pick. I gather you have been grappling with something else.
So my pick this episode is a great article from the folks over at Flawless App, and it's all about a deep dive into strings. Now, I really enjoyed this article, and I learned a lot, actually, you know, specifically around performance issues with strings. And I wanted to talk about this because I think many new developers overlook this deep dive into string, right? A string is like the first thing you learn, right? What do you learn? Let string equal hello world, you know? I think developers need to, or new developers coming in, need to really do a deep dive into these strings.
I think a lot of folks realize Swift strings are special when they try to read a character using an integer index, because it's downhill from there on, right?
Yeah, well, more on that later, a little foreshadowing there. even though it seems, you know, simple and it is the first thing you learn, you know, like we just said, there's more to it than that. And I think the author sums it up nicely, so I'll just kind of quote them. The string type is easy and straightforward. However, it is complicated under the hood. The string type needs to handle the glyphs of various languages, the reading order of languages, and many other locale-specific behaviors. Moreover, the storage and display of a string in a modern computer system is also a big issue. All of these are elegantly wrapped into an easy and intuitive string type, end quote.
I've never heard anyone describe Swift strings as being intuitive or easy in my life. Only a few minutes ago, we were talking about Ian Partridge, like a senior IBM developer, complaining about strings. I mean, imagine if you had an interview question and you didn't have code completion and it was about strings. Who could pass that?
Not me, that's for sure. Back to the article. It starts off, you know, talking about character encoding, which is something I've never really had the need to look into. You know, I imagine you would probably study this, you know, in CS as you're getting your degree and your traditional learning. I do not have that background, so I really learned a lot here. I learned that in Unicode, each character has a code point. You know, for example, the code point of the snowboarding emoji is U+1F3C2, which can also be converted to a binary number. And each character, you know, gets converted into bytes, and then you have to store them into, you know, 32, 16, or 8-bit containers. And you may have seen, you know, UTF-8, UTF-16, you know, out there. I had always seen these. I just never really knew what they meant. So now I kind of do, I guess. At least I have a better idea. And in Swift, you can initialize a string using a code point, such as the snowboarding one I mentioned, that, you know, U(1F30A). Actually, that's for the wave emoji, not the snowboarding emoji. I know, I messed that one up. But you can combine these Unicode, you know, code points when initializing a string to create more complex characters. That was something that I didn't know either. You know, some things that you may see in other languages. A very simple example of that is adding an accent mark over the letter, like the letter E, which you can do combining Unicode. This is called, you know, a grapheme cluster. Again, a new thing I learned about. And even when you combine a bunch of these to create a complex character, Swift will still count it as one character when doing the character count on a string.
Do you have a favorite emoji, Sean?
The one, that's a good question. No.
You got to give me a Unicode code point for it though, okay?
Yeah. I'm going to start memorizing all these, yeah. I actually don't have a favorite emoji. I use the thumbs up and smiley faces a lot, but yeah, they're not really that interesting.
I think everyone likes U1F4A9. Is that one of your favorites as well?
For sure, definitely, yeah. Way better than 08. That's, way better than 08.
Yeah, 08, rubbish, yeah. That's the pile of poo emoji. But this goes back to what I was saying earlier, you know, finding a character by position in, as an index is an order n operation rather than linear time, thanks to those grapheme clusters.
Yeah, and that's like you just mentioned, there's no random access. So random access means just like subscripting at the end. So if you're ever wondering, you know, why you can't do, you know, let string equal hello world and then try to find the fourth character by doing string, you know, open bracket for close bracket for to get that character.
You could do it. You totally could do it. They just don't want you to do it because they know it's slow and people using it wouldn't realize it was slow. So it would just cause problems.
I got an error when I did it in Xcode. Just when I was prepping for this, I was like, wait, I thought you could do that. And then I opened up a playground. I was like, nope, I got an error.
No, I mean, as in you could write an extension to do it. It's trivial to write an extension to do this thing for you. That's subscripting on arrays. It's trivial to do, but they haven't included it because they know they'll have someone saying looping over characters in a string every other one, for example, and pull out the one at that index, which would be a quadratic runtime. It'd be hideously slow.
So they
try and avoid that kind of problem.
Yeah, it's almost kind of like protecting you from yourself because doing this subscripting is relatively easy, right? You know, developers will probably rely on it and that's not very performant. So yeah, it's kind of a, you know, protecting you from yourself sort of a thing. So the answer here is that, you know, Swift strings use index. So if you did want to find that specific character, you know, you would use string.index, you know, index offset by, and then you would throw in a number in there like 8 or 9 or whatever. And then you can also find the first instance of a character by using, you know, string.index, first index of, you know, the letter Q or whatever.
I'm pretty sure that grapheme clusters are terrifying for everyone. And in fact, possibly they are the only thing scarier for Swift newcomers than the words functional programming.
Right. I know when I read this article, that was the first time I ever heard that term. And I was like, what the hell are they talking about? Grapheme? What? So, yeah, that was new to me. I also learned a lot about the performance of string in substring. Like when you create a substring from a host string, you know, Swift doesn't allocate new memory for that substring. And instead creates a range indicator that points to the range of the substring, you know, within the existing string. An example of that, if you took my name, you know, Sean Allen as the string, and you wanted to have a substring of just Sean, basically the, you know, Sean is a substring of Sean Allen. And this makes substrings fast and efficient, but there is a bit of a catch. The substring and string are pointing to the same space in memory. So if you keep a reference to the substring, but remove the host string, that entire memory space of the host string is still retained. So just to kind of throw out a crazy example, if you have a string that's 10,000 characters and you create a very, very small substring of that that's only 10 characters, but then you remove that host string, you're still retaining the memory space for that 10,000 characters.
Right. So it's a small but important performance optimization. I think realistically, it's not too likely you'll get hit by the memory issue.
Yeah, and substrings are typically used in a local scope, so within a function, so it gets removed when it's no longer needed. So you have a good point there. And the final thing I learned was that strings are value types that uses copy on write. Now, I was familiar with copy on write, but you know, just knowing that strings use that as well. Now, what this means is that when you create a string, you know, let's say you call it string one and you set a value to it, and then you create another variable called string two, and then you set that equal to string one, that's essentially, you know, making a copy. So then those variables will occupy the same memory space for performance and efficiency. But once you modify one of the strings, a new memory space will be created.
This is probably one of those ultimate well actuallys in Swift. When someone says their value types, Swift implements them, as you've seen with copy on write, using a reference type. So because it's under the hood, it implements reference type and uses value type semantics, which is ultimately all that matters. We don't care if it's a reference type underneath, all we care is it acts like a value type.
Yeah, like you said, we want to know how it acts so we know how to use it. You know, what, like you said, what goes on under the hood? Sure. But overall, I really enjoyed this article. And like I mentioned at the beginning, I just think many new developers, you know, myself included, really overlooked this deep dive, you know, into going what on the surface may seem simple, you know, according to the our author of the article. But, you know, this article is a great start to that deep dive, and we'll just kind of open up Pandora's box of a whole rabbit hole to jump down.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite section. It's our open ballot. And our question this time was, ARKit, what's it really good for? And once again, we had so many responses. Thank you so much. You know, if as many folks we had leaving responses to open ballot would leave reviews on the podcast thing, we'd be billionaires by now, I'm sure.
Number one podcast in the app
store. Yeah. Podcasts get billionaire money. It's a thing, isn't it? You know?
Maybe.
We had stacks of responses about sales, how it's being used in the sales experience. Brent Lecomte said, I can see it being used to make a shopping experience more interesting, putting shoes in the real world, making them appear in the real world via a portal, who knows, perhaps in a wearable glass in the future. I'm the Goat said, from what I've seen, there's a lot of apps that allow you to try clothes or furniture in your own home. This allows users to try a product out online without having to go to a store. And Ion said, in marketing and sales or in medical science, ARKit might be a big hit in coming days. So yes, sales appears to be the biggest use case right now. It's as close as we have to a killer app. Things like the IKEA app, I think that's actually shown during DubDub at one point. We could put one of the bland chairs in your front room and say, look, it doesn't fit straight away. I'm not going to buy that one. But it shows you in a visual way you just wouldn't get from a catalog.
Yeah, I just got to echo what everyone has said here. I do think sales will be most likely one of the first, you know, major spaces for ARKit to really take off. And like, you know, the reasons have already been said.
We have some answers here regarding industrial uses. Gilbert Martinez says, we have use cases where a mechanic can use a phone to overlay schematics on top of it. That way they can locate specific parts or suggestions where a problem might be. Mikaluch says, used it along with Vision and OpenCV for my last contract, which is all about assisted driving. And Cyril Garcia says, I see ARKit playing a bigger role in games than everyday applications. It's definitely the coolest tech anyone can play with in their phones, but that's the extent of it. Now, actually, Cyril's point is, I think, where some of the ARKit hype comes from. It is extremely cool. I've seen a number of very, very good ARKit demos on Twitter that I know, having developed with ARKit, are all completely infeasible for a number of technical reasons. I still love them, I'm still excited by them, and I hope it gets better, but I know in practice, it'll never work. For example, there was one that, you know, scanned a business card, detected the person's name, and then put their Twitter bio around it and their homepage and stuff, and that only works if you have pre-scanned every business card in the world into your app. It's not feasible, right? It's cool, it's very clever, but it's just not feasible right now. So I'm glad to see things like this OpenCV and Vision thing for assisted driving. That's a real world user example, making the world better, not just cool, not just clever. It's actually useful to improve the world.
Right, I agree. And I feature a lot of this stuff on Swift News. And I do think, to your point about how it's not feasible yet, but I just think we're in this playground right now of experimentation, right? I do believe ARKit is a few years away, but I love seeing all these prototypes.
We had some answers here on education. We have one from Subin Revi saying, I guess it could be useful in the field of education where you can show the objects or images in a 3D model. Since ARKit gives that real life feel, it will stick to the person's memory more than a plain 2D image would. And for kids, nothing is more exciting than seeing an animated image. And Philip Nemechek said, I think image recognition from ARKit could have a lot of use cases. For example, you could scan art in a museum and then get displayed non-AR content in your language with maybe some animations or other pictures, where a QR code would be clumsy.
Yeah, I want to agree with Subin here. I think education, aside from retail, like we talked about before, is another huge space. I've seen some, you know, prototypes of, you know, dissecting a frog and or even just the human anatomy where, you know, you can zoom in, pan around. It's a 3D model, right? So you can spin it around. And, you know, like he says, like I would have learned so much better if I could explore and play around like that. And it would have been more interesting to me because back in my day, you know, there were just, you know, illustrated diagrams on a piece of paper, you know,
on the chalkboard.
Yeah, exactly. Some crude drawing, you know. But if I had this, you know, could play around, zoom in, like I would have probably spent all day just like going through the human body, looking at everything.
You know, once someone told me that they really preferred their Kindle for reading to their iPad, not because like the screen was different or anything, but because there was always a temptation with the iPad to press the home button, go to Twitter or go to BBC News or some app and poof, your reading is gone. You're just distracted so easily. With a Kindle, you just can't do that. It's a reading device and not much more. And I think if we gave kids phones in their class, said, yes, go in there and dissect the frog, whatever, they would all be on Twitter or something, Snapchat straight away instead.
Yeah, and you get those notifications popping down. That's what always takes me out of my reading experience. I got to turn, you know, do not disturb on.
Right. I think Philip's point is interesting because I've talked to a group who are working on this museum AR kit exact thing in Italy. And, you know, with AR kit image scanning, there's a maximum you can have about 25 pictures being scanned at a time. So recognize one of 25 pictures in an art gallery, which is not very many. If you want to scan more than that, you have to either rotate through your detections. So like look for one, look for another, look for another. So you basically one a second cycle through. There's a slight delay. If the image is in the last set of 100, for example, it might take 3 seconds to be recognized, but at least it means you can go through them all ultimately. But what they were doing was even better because many museums work in rooms. Here is our Renaissance room. Here's our Italian Masters room or whatever. They were able to combine that scanning thing with iBeacons to say, you are now in this room and we know you are because we can take the iBeacon for that room. Now activate the image recognition set for that room. The 25 images in this room we know can be scanned. So it meant it worked around the limitation very nicely by combining another less well-known technology, iBeacons, to make a really smart app that was even cleverer.
Yeah, I like that efficiency.
We had one piece of negative feedback from Amar saying, in general, ARKit falls behind other AR platforms. For example, other platforms have solved the occlusion problem. ARKit still hasn't. And in fact, I saw that just today. One of the engineers from SAP was here at iOS Conf Singapore, and he was demonstrating SceneKit with ARKit on the thing. And he placed a model TIE fighter 10 meters away, and it was moving around 10 meters away, which is very cool. But then he said, watch this. And he put his hand in front of the camera, and his hand went behind the TIE fighter, which was 10 meters away in scene space, because it can't do occlusion. It can't understand your hands in front of the TIE fighter, whereas Google Tango has solved that. So ARKit is, in that case, a little bit behind.
Yeah, but I don't, me personally, and again, I'm just drinking the apple Kool-Aid. I don't worry about that because, again, I think we're still years away. ARKit, I'm confident it'll catch up. You know, it's making rapid improvements year to year.
So we have some views here that the best is yet to come. Christaps Grinberg's a real friend of the show, said, honestly, I haven't done anything with ARKit. So far, I've seen some cool demos and games on empty large wooden tables, but something meaningful, I guess, yet to come. Thomas Wood says, ARKit's a great way for developers to prep for making apps that work with Apple glasses, whatever Apple calls the eye-based wearable they are no doubt developing. It isn't super practical now, but it's like a playground for the future. And Dan O'Leary replied to Thomas Wood saying, I agree with this completely. The reason I'm learning about AR is not what I can make on the iPad or iPhone. It's so I can be in a good position to make software for products not yet announced.
Yeah, and as I've alluded to in some of the previous answers, this is my exact take on ARKit. Like I said, it's just an experimental playground right now. I do believe, and I've said this many times before, ARKit's not going to, or just AR in general, is not going to take off until we can have, you know, reasonable glasses on our face that aren't ridiculously looking and huge, you know, to be we can walk around, you know, the world and see this stuff. As long as you have to hold up your iPad or phone, it's not gonna take off. So I agree with these guys.
And one final one to end on a nice positive note. Ludwig Eriksson said, AR, huh, yeah. What's it good for? Absolutely nothing. He's like the anti-Sean.
I don't think he got his joke, Paul. He did the, and I thought, I honestly, when you put out the question, I thought we were going to get 100 of these responses. I'm surprised he only did the one, but it's the old song. I can't remember who sings it. I'm not old enough to remember, but it's that war. What is it good for? Absolutely not. You know, you're looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about. You never heard that song? Or you just want
now
me to sing it?
Now you sing it with your dulcet tones. I haven't heard that song. I would never have got that in a million years otherwise.
No, the way you posed the question, that was like the first thing I thought of too. And I was like, oh, I bet we're going to get a lot of those. But Ludwig was the only one. So that's going to do it for this episode of Swift Over Coffee. But as always, we want to leave you with the next open ballot. We want to leave you with something to think about. And that is, apart from Swift and framework knowledge, you know, what are the key skills for an iOS developer?
Well, obviously, reading great books from me and watching great videos from you, Sean. Is there anything else?
No, not at all. Just do that. You'll be amazing. You know, there's nothing else out there that'll help you. Sarcasm, obviously. There's tons of great content out there. But that's going to do it. Tell all your friends to subscribe. And like Paul mentioned earlier, leave a review for the podcast. It really, really helps us out. And then don't forget to follow us on Twitter @SwiftOverCoffee. We'll see you in the next one.
Bye.